And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I am very excited about an upcoming presentation that I will be making along with Chris Pederson. I want you to mark your calendars. This is going to happen on October 11th. It will be at, I believe, 6:30 East Coast time, and it will be sponsored by AAII, and it's my understanding that there will be dozens of AAII chapters aboard for the presentation, and certainly you will all be invited. And as I understand it, it is free. I do know that a donation to AAII would be greatly appreciated, but not necessary. I am excited because it is the first presentation I will make in October. The same month I'll be speaking to the Bogleheads Conference, and both presentations, as far as the part that I'll make, will be about small cap value. In the case of the Bogleheads Conference, I'll have 20 minutes, but in the case of AAII, they are giving me a 60-minute time frame, and Chris will follow me with a combination of some information on two funds for life and how to select the best in-class ETFs. So we hope you can join us. I am extremely excited about the presentation on small cap value because I've been working for weeks now. I've got some 14 wonderful tables to share with you, some information that I've never shared before, and even got some wonderful help from Ben Felix and the folks at Advantis. It's going to be, for me, it's going to be fun. For you, I hope it's going to be a worthy educational experience. Today, I want to share just a bit of one of the articles from Ben Carlson. As I've said many times, I read him every morning as early as I can get up, and find his work to always be interesting. Plus, at the end of each article, there's a wonderful list of other information you might want to follow up on that will broaden your education. I highly recommend his work. In this particular case, the article is entitled "The Luckiest Generation." And while I want to focus on this lucky generation, I also want to focus on what do you do when you're not so lucky. But let's talk about the luckiest generation for a minute. He's talking about the baby boomers. And he says they are by far one of the wealthiest generations the world has ever seen. The fact that there are more than 70 million people in this demographic helps, but it's also true that this is one of the luckiest generations in history when it comes to returns on financial assets. Then he lists, for stocks, bonds, and housing, what the returns have been since 1983. For stocks, 7,930%. For bonds, 1,060%. For housing, 515%. And those annual returns equate to 11.4 for stocks, 6.2 for bonds, and 4.6 for housing. And if you simply left your money in a savings account during this period of time, since going back to 83, you would have been up nearly 300%. And he's quick to mention this does not include transaction costs and fees and taxes and the impact of your behavior. But this has been arguably the greatest 40-something year period in the history of financial markets, and the baby boomer generation has benefited mightily. Now, I will say that starting in 1932 or 33, the S&P 500 compounded at 12.5%. But you certainly did not have the huge returns in bonds that have happened over this last 40 years. A 60-40 portfolio, he goes on, of U.S. stocks and bonds returned 14.5% per year from 1980 to 1999. That's nearly 15% annual returns for two whole decades, with 40% of your money sitting in boring old bonds. He notes the long-term return for the U.S. stocks over the past 100 years or so was 9.7% a year. He notes, combine this with the fact that housing prices are up more than 500% since the early 1980s, and it seems like shooting fish in a barrel to build wealth for the baby boomers. And they had the advantage also, by the way, he notes, that they didn't have to deal with student loans. Boomers had it easy, he states. But there's another side to that story, just so you know it. Although this was a great time to be in the market, if you did buy a house in the early 80s, you could pay 15 to 20% in mortgage rates. If you were an investor in the 80s, you had to live through the one-day decline of 20% in a single day in 1987. And while that period had the 1980s and 90s, a bull market run that was unbelievable, but it was followed, remember, by the lost decade of 2000 through 2009, and that included two declines of over 50%. The Great Financial Crisis, he notes, saw the entire financial system on the brink of collapse. So it was definitely a good news, bad news story, as investing tends to be. But he does note, and I think this is so true, there is more luck involved in financial outcomes than most of us would like to admit. No one gets to choose when they are born or the circumstances they are born into. I had the good fortune, and I shouldn't say good fortune because it meant that my father didn't come back from World War II, but because he didn't come back from World War II, I actually qualified for the GI Bill when I went to college. And there are a lot of things that happened in our life that was not sitting on anybody's life plan or financial plan. But I think understanding there can be good news, we also know there can be bad news. And one of the things I want to make sure that we teach, and hopefully you do, is to be sure that all those things that we can control that will cause us to come up short in terms of returns are important steps to take. And of course, that means buying no load instead of load funds. It means buying index funds instead of actively managed funds. It means investing in tax-advantaged investments versus taxable investments. And it means controlling your emotions. And of course, dollar cost averaging goes a long way to doing that, but it doesn't always keep people from jumping ship. Well, I want to share today, in fact, there's a link in the notes to the annual SPIVA report. I think it's important to remind ourselves that the range of returns that we are likely to get on our investments are a combination of the kinds of securities, I'm talking again, indexing and low expenses and low taxes, and high discipline on our parts. But the SPIVA report, I think, is one of the most interesting studies. Every 6 months, it comes out of Standard & Poor's. And it is about 44 pages long. There's something interesting on every page, but I'm going to highlight a handful of pages that have some wonderful lessons for us on them. The first page I'm looking at, page 9, is a report that is the percentage of U.S. equity funds underperforming their benchmarks based on absolute return. Now, this is going to include both the capital appreciation and any distributions that they make during the year. And they break down the returns for 1, 3, 5, 10, 15, and 20 years. And they have other things they break down. For example, on page 9, they show how many of the funds, and they're focused not on index funds, but actively managed funds, were able to do as well as the benchmark. Well, the interesting thing is when you look at 1 year, in most cases, it's kind of a 50-50 probability. When we look at this last year and you looked at all domestic funds, half beat the benchmark and half didn't. There are some areas, for some reason, why many didn't. In mid-cap growth, I'm not sure why, but 91% of those funds underperformed their benchmark. And when we get out to 10 years, it's a range of 65% underperformed, and that particular 65% was mid-cap growth. Interesting. It actually did well for 10 years relative to the others because the rest of them, most of them were in the 80s and the 90s of underperformance. And the worst of the bunch was the multi-cap core funds, the S&P 500 Composite 1500, where the funds had a number of different asset classes, where 97% underperformed the index or the benchmark itself. But they go all the way out to 20 years. And by the time you get to 20 years, the range is mostly all of them are in the 90s. And so it's going to be maybe 1 out of 10 to 1 out of 20 mutual funds are going to be able to beat the benchmark. So to the extent that we happen to live through a bad period of time, we would like to invest so that we have a high probability of ending up in that top 10%. And that top 10% is generally going to suggest that you need to be in an index fund. And by the way, a low-cost index fund, because you can buy an S&P 500 fund for with a 1% expense ratio, or you can buy it with 0.03%, or you can even buy it free. They also look on page 10, they also look at the percentage of U.S. equity funds underperforming their benchmark based on risk-adjusted returns. You see, some fund may pick out of the S&P 500 and therefore qualify to be a large cap blend type of a fund, but maybe they only own 20 or 30 companies. So they're taking a great deal more risk. And what is interesting, let's just look out at the 20-year period. When we look at the 20-year period, the percentages of mutual funds that are able to beat the benchmark risk-adjusted goes down considerably. In fact, you've got a number of these asset classes that are in the high 90s. Large cap growth funds, for example, over 99% were unable to do better than the benchmark over 20 years. And now I'm looking at page 13, where they discuss in report 2, survivorship and style consistency of U.S. equity funds. Now, by the way, all of these topics are discussed as well and shown for international funds and for bond funds. And I'll just talk mostly here about the U.S. equity, just so you'll get a taste of what might be interesting for you to take some time and dig into this report. But they look, for example, how many funds there were 20 years ago in these different categories. For example, all large cap funds, there were 825 of them. And of those 825, there are only 28% left. Mid-cap value, there were 102 and there are 51% left. In some cases, there's as little as here, large cap growth, 22% left. So what that says is that when you look at the Morningstar returns for the last 15 years for funds, you're going to get the returns of the funds that are in that particular asset class for all or part of that 15 years, but you were not going to pick up the funds that were dropped along the way because of poor performance. So when you see the average performance, it is not as good as what really happened because so many funds didn't survive. Now, by the way, I don't want people to panic. It doesn't mean that people who were in those funds lost all their money. No, they get merged, names get changed, track records get buried. And here's the other part that's important. They also show in this report how consistent those funds were in delivering the asset class they said they were going to deliver. See, when you get an index fund, you know what asset class you're getting. With the S&P 500, you're not going to end up with the Russell 2000. But over this particular period of time, the 20 years, in some cases, for example, mid-cap value, I notice here, only 15% were kept the same style through the whole period. Here, small cap value, only 22% kept the same asset class through the 20 years. And nothing, well, let's see, there's one asset class, large cap core, 58%. Were the same style over that 20 years. So this is one of the things you need to understand with actively managed funds. Not only are a lot of them not going to survive, but those that you bought thinking they were going to be large cap growth may not have ended up being large cap growth. Now, you may want the manager to do however they feel, like whether they want to be small, large, growth, or value, U.S. or international. But one of the things we've all been taught, and certainly we believe in, is trying to identify asset classes and put them into a portfolio that we can count on them remaining in that asset class because they're there for a purpose. Now, also, we have here on page 14 of the report, report number 3, average U.S. equity fund performance. Now, what they show here is what the average was in that particular asset class. So, for example, large cap growth funds had for 20 years a, on average, 8.57% return. The index that matches that is the S&P 500 growth. That compound rate of return was 10.3. S&P large cap value, 8.93. The funds in large cap value, 7.64. And you can look at all of the major equity asset classes, the benchmark, and you can look at 1, 3, 5, 10, and 20-year performance. And I don't think I need to change your mind anyway, but it helps, I think, to strengthen your commitment to index funds to see the difference between, for example, S&P small cap 600 growth, 10.97, but the average fund in that category made 8.92. Now we're going to talk about average and how that isn't the only thing you should be focusing on. Because the other thing, and I'm going to page 17 in the report here, the other thing you need to understand is that there's a wide range of performance with funds. If you look 1 year at a time at this report, if we look just at the year 2022, we have all of these different fund asset classes, and we have the percentage return that marks the first quartile. In other words, all equity funds that were higher than a negative 9.74. Remember, 22 was a bad year. Funds were losing money, not making money. But if you were in the top 25%, and that was from a negative 9.74 to higher, there might even have been some funds that made money. But they were better than a negative 9.74. The second quartile starts at a minus 17.53. So there were a whole bunch of funds that lost twice as much as those in the first quartile. But then we look at the start of the third quartile. And from 25% to 50%, the third quartile starts at a loss of 26.9, which means that 25% of the domestic U.S. funds lost more than 26.91%. So that tells you a lot of people had a really, really bad year in 2022. Now, you would also see something interesting. You'd be able here to compare how other asset classes, let me take you to a good one that did relatively well. Small cap value funds. They ranged in the first quartile was a loss of 5.05. So there were 25% of the funds that did better than losing 5%. Maybe some of those even made a little money. When you go to the second quartile, it's at a negative 10%. And the third quartile, a negative 12%. So obviously, small cap value did much, much better than the average equity asset class. And we can go on out and see that all the way out to 20 years. Now, there was a wide difference between the best and the worst when you're at 1 year at a time. But when we look out 20 years, the range narrows. We've shown that in looking at the one-year returns of asset classes, having from best to worst, like the S&P 500, I think the best year is up 53 and the worst year is down 43 or something like that. So that's a huge difference. But when you get out to 40-year periods, the best 40-year period with the S&P 500 is a plus 12.5. The worst is a plus 8.9. So you will not be surprised that when we look at all domestic funds, the first quartile for 20 years starts at 9.89 and the second quartile 9.12%, and the third quartile is 8.27% return over the 20 years. So they're relatively well bunched, but remember, we've talked endlessly about the importance of an extra half of 1%. And it looks to me like, as I look at these difference between the first, second, and third quartiles, that there are some differences of a lot more than a half percent. And remember, in that final quartile, you're going to have that bottom 25%. You're going to have some really, really poor performance potentially. If we do look at the small cap value funds, the first quartile starts at 9.84, the second at 9.25, and the third at 8.76. And by the way, the returns for this 20-year period were very similar throughout all of these different asset classes. It is an aspect of this period that has made small and value not as precious as some other periods. And the international asset classes look very similar. What's interesting is when you look at fixed income, there it really tightens up, but I would bet that the most important variable in terms of fixed income is going to be the fees that are being charged. Because it is not unusual to see management companies getting a half to three quarters of 1% to manage a portfolio that is built to make 3%, which means a lot of what you're getting, making, is being eaten up by the management fee. But still, I notice here, under general government funds, looking out over the 15 years, that's as far out as they go, not 20. The first quartile is at 2.84, the second quartile at 2.06, and the third quartile at 1.73. Now, this is a really, really low-risk part of the market. And yet, I think, again, because of fees, that is going to cause what I would consider to be almost a catastrophic impact, because the whole idea of being in these kinds of funds is to keep your risk low. And when you're paying high management fees to manage a low-risk investment, that's counterproductive. And we know that. Sometimes we're just, we have some funds we got bought at Franklin or Templeton or something decades ago and just haven't taken the time to move to a bond fund that doesn't charge so much. So I hope you will go visit that the SPIVA report. And you, when you run into somebody who really thinks that the idea, the best way to do this is to use actively managed funds, do them a favor. Sit down and go through this report so they can see how unlikely it is by buying active managers that they're going to do better. And normally they don't even take into consideration the additional taxes they're paying if it's in a taxable account. And this all matters so much when we have a bad luck period rather than a good luck period. And so I hope some of this helps. And I hope you've made a little note on your calendar for October 11. I'm thrilled to have Chris back from vacation. I think Daryl is going to be back in the next day or two from vacation, and I'll get those guys back together, and we'll discuss the topics that you have on your mind. Thanks for all that you do to spread the word to other people. And by the way, thanks to all of you who have taken the time to write and tell me about the things that you're doing to try to spread this information to other folks. And remember, this isn't just about spreading my information, our information. It's also about spreading the work of Rob Berger and Larry Swedrow and Ben Felix. Oh, Ben Felix has got an absolutely phenomenal table for me to share with you when I do my presentation on October 11. Anyway, we'll keep doing our part. We hope you'll keep doing your part by coming back and considering what we hope will make your financial future better. Thank you.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.